complete deactivation of so complex a machine as a missile submarine requires the services of a shipyard. The missile compartment must be physically removed from the body of the vessel. And so these vessels cannot be fully disarmed overnight. However, to make the honesty of our intentions undeniable, we invite the United States to do one of two things. First, we will permit a selected team of 6 American naval officers to inspect these 20 vessels to verify that their missile tubes have been filled with concrete ballast, pending removal of the entire missile rooms from all of the submarines. In return for this, we would require that a comparable inspection visit by an equal number of Soviet officers to American yards would be allowed at a later date to be agreed on. Second, as an alternative, should the United States be unwilling to allow reciprocal verification of arms reductions, we will permit another group of 6 officers to perform this service, these officers to be from a country or countries upon which the United States and the Soviet Union can agree within the next 30 days. A team from such neutral countries as Sweden or India would be acceptable in principle to the Soviet Union. Ladies and gentlemen, the time has come to put an end to the arms race. I will not repeat all of the flowery rhetoric we've all heard over the past 2 generations. We all know the threat that these ghastly weapons represent to every nation. Let no one ever say again that the government of the Soviet Union has not done its part to reduce the danger of war. Thank you. The room suddenly fell silent, but for the sound of motor-driven still cameras. The Western press representatives assigned to their respective Moscow bureaus were among the best in their profession. Uniformly bright, uniformly ambitious, uniformly cynical about what they found in Moscow and the conditions under which they were forced to work, all were stunned to silence. "God damn," muttered Flynn after a full 10 seconds.
"One must admire your understatement, old boy," agreed Reuters correspondent William Calloway. "Wasn't it your Wilson who spoke of open covenants openly arrived at?"
"Yeah, my granddad covered that peace conference.
Remember how well it worked out?" Flynn grimaced, watching the foreign minister depart, smiling at the cameras.
"I want to see the handout. Want to ride back with me?"
"Yes, on both."
It was a bitterly cold day in Moscow. Snow piles were heaped at the roadsides. The sky was a frigid crystal blue. And the car's heater didn't work. Flynn drove while his friend read aloud through the handout. The draft treaty proposal took up 19 annotated pages. The Reuters correspondent was a Londoner who had begun as a police reporter, and since covered assignments all over the world. He and Flynn had met many years before at the famous Caravel Hotel in Saigon, and shared drinks and typewriter ribbons on and off for more than 2 decades. In the face of a Russian winter, they remembered the oppressive heat of Saigon with something akin to nostalgia.
"It's bloody fair," Calloway said wonderingly, his breath giving ghostly substance to his words. "They propose a build-down with elimination of many existing weapons, allowing both sides to replace obsolete launchers, both sides to reach a total of 5,000 deliverable warheads, that number to remain stable for 5 years after the 3-year reduction period. There is a separate proposal to negotiate complete removal of heavy missiles, replacing them with mobile missiles, but to limit missile flight tests to a fixed number per year." He flipped that page and rapidly scanned the remainder.
"Nothing in the draft treaty about your Star Wars research."
"Didn't he mention that in his statement?"
"Patrick, old son, this is, as you say, dynamite. This could as easily have been written in Washington. It will take months to work out all the technical points, but this is a bloody serious and bloody generous proposal."
"Nothing about Star Wars?"
Flynn frowned briefly as he turned right. Did that mean that the Russians had made a breakthrough of their own? Have to query Washington about that. "We got us a story here, Willie. What's your lead? How's peace grab you?" Calloway just laughed at that. Fort Meade, Maryland. American intelligence agencies, like their counterparts throughout the world, monitor all news wire services. Toland was examining the AP and Reuters reports before most news bureau chiefs, and comparing them with the version transmitted over Soviet microwave circuits for publication in the regional editions of Pravda and Izvestia. The way items of hard news were reported in the Soviet Union was intended to show party members how their leaders felt. "We've been down this road before," his section chief said. "The last time things broke down on this issue of mobile missiles. Both sides want them, but both sides are afraid of the other side having them." But the tone of the report. They're always euphoric about their arms control proposals, damn it. Hell, Bob, you know that. True, sir, but it's the first time that I know of that the Russians have unilaterally removed a weapons platform from service. The Yankees are obsolete. So what? They never throw anything away, obsolete or not. They still have World War II artillery pieces sitting in warehouses in case they need them again. This is different. And the political ramifications... "We're not talking politics, we're talking nuclear strategy," the section chief growled back. "As if there were a difference," Toland said to himself. Kiev, the Ukraine. "Well, Pasha?" "Comrade General, we truly have a man's work before us," Alexeyev answered, standing at attention in the Kiev headquarters of the Southwest Theater. "Our troops need extensive unit training. Over the weekend, I read through more than 80 regimental readiness reports from our tank and motor rifle divisions." Alexeyev paused before going on. Tactical training and readiness was the bane of the Soviet military. Their troops were almost entirely conscripts, in and out in 2 years, half of whose uniformed service was occupied just in acquiring basic military skills. Even the non-coms, the backbone of every army since the Roman legions, were conscripts selected for special training academies, then lost as soon as their enlistment periods ended. For that reason, the Soviet military leaned heavily on its officers, who often performed what in the West was sergeant's work. The professional officer corps of the Soviet Army was its only permanent, only dependable feature. In theory. The truth of the matter is that we don't know our readiness posture at the moment. Our colonels all use the same language in their reports, without the slightest deviation. Everyone reports meeting norms, with the same amount of training hours, the same amount of political indoctrination, the same number of practice shots fired. That is a deviation of under 3%. And the requisite number of field exercises run, all, of course, of the proper type. "As prescribed in our training manuals," the Colonel General noted. "Naturally. Exactly. Too damned exactly. No deviation for adverse weather. No deviation for late fuel deliveries. No deviation for anything at all. For example, the 703rd Motor Rifle Regiment spent all of last October on harvesting duty south of Kharkov. Yet, somehow, they met their monthly norms for unit training at the same time. Lies are bad enough, but these are stupid lies."
"It cannot be as bad as you fear, Pavel Leonidovich."
"Do we dare to assume otherwise, comrade?"
The general stared down at his desk.
"No."
"Very well, Pasha. You've formulated your plan. Let me hear it." "For the moment, you will be outlining the plan for our attack into the Muslim lands. I must get into the field to whip our field commanders into shape. If we wish to accomplish our goals in time for the attack west, we must make an example of the worst offenders. I have four commanders in mind. Their conduct has been grossly and undeniably criminal. Here are the names and charges." He handed over a single sheet of paper.
"There are two good men here, Pasha," the general objected.
"They are guardians of the state. They enjoy positions of the greatest trust. They have betrayed that trust by lying, and in doing so they have endangered the state," Alexeyev said, wondering how many men in his country could have that said of them. He dismissed the thought. There were problems enough right here.
You understand the consequences of the charges you bring?
Of course. The penalty for treason is death. Did I ever falsify a readiness report? Did you?
Alexeyev looked away briefly. It is a hard thing, and I take no pleasure in it. But unless we snap our units into shape, how many young boys will die for their officers' failings? We need combat readiness more than we need four liars. If there is a gentler way to achieve this, I don't know what that might be. An army without discipline is a worthless mob. We have the directive from Stavka to make examples of unruly privates and restore the authority of our NCOs. It is fitting that if privates must suffer for their failings, then their colonels must suffer too. Theirs is the greater responsibility. Theirs is the greater reward. A few examples here will go a long way to restoring our army.
The inspectorate?
The best choice, Alexeyev agreed. That way, blame would not necessarily be traced back to the senior commanders themselves. I can send teams from the Inspector General's service out to these regiments day after tomorrow. Our training memoranda arrived in all divisional and regimental headquarters this morning. The news of these four traitors will encourage our unit commanders to implement them with vigor. Even then, it will be 2 weeks before we have a clear picture of what we need to focus on. But once we can identify the areas that need buttressing, we should have ample time to accomplish what we need to accomplish.
What will Sink West be doing?
The same, one hopes.
Alexeyev shook his head.
Has he asked for any of our units yet?
No, but he will. We will not be ordered to launch offensive operations against NATO's southern flank, part of the continuing Maskirovka. You may assume that many of our Category B units will be detailed to Germany, possibly some of our A-tank forces also. However many divisions that fool has, he'll want more.
Just so we have enough troops to seize the oil fields when the time comes, Pasha observed.
Which plan are we supposed to execute?
The old one. We'll have to update it, of course.
The old plan predated Soviet involvement in Afghanistan, and now the Red Army had a whole new perspective on sending mechanized forces into an area occupied by armed Muslims.
Alexeyev's hands bunched into fists.
Marvelous. We must formulate a plan without knowing when it will be implemented or what forces we'll have available to execute it.
Remember what you told me about the life of a staff officer, Pasha? Sink Southwest chuckled.
The younger man nodded ruefully, hoist on his own petard.
Indeed, Comrade General. We will do our sleeping after the war.
Chapter 5 Sailors and Spooks. The Chesapeake Bay, Maryland. His eyes squinted painfully at the horizon. The sun was only half a diameter above the green-brown line of Maryland's eastern shore, a reminder, if he needed one, that he'd worked late the day before, gone to bed later still, then arisen at 4:30, so that he could get in a day's fishing. A slowly receding sinus-like headache also let him know about the six-pack of beer he'd consumed in front of the TV. But it was his first fishing day of the year, and the casting rod felt good in his hand as he gave it a gentle swing toward a ripple on the calm surface of the Chesapeake Bay. A blue or a rockfish? Whatever it was, it didn't nibble at his bucktail lure. But there was no hurry.
Coffee, Bob?
Thanks, Pop. Robert Toland set his rod in its holder and leaned back into the midship's swivel chair of his Boston Whaler Outrage. His father-in-law, Edward Keegan, held out the plastic cup cap from a large thermos jug. Bob knew the coffee would be good. Ned Keegan was a former naval officer who appreciated a good cup, preferably flavored with brandy or Irish whiskey, something to open the eyes and put a fire in the belly.
"Cold or not, damn if it ain't nice to get out here."
Keegan sipped at his cup, resting one foot on the bait box. It wasn't just the fishing, both men agreed. Getting out on the water was one sure cure for civilization. "Be nice if the Rock really are coming back, too," Toland observed. "What the hell? No phones." "What about your beeper?" "I must have left it with my other pants," Keegan chuckled. "DIA will have to manage without me today." "Think they can?" "Well, the Navy did." Keegan was an Academy graduate who had put in his 30 and retired to become a double dipper. In uniform, he'd been an intelligence specialist, and now he had essentially the same job, which added civil service salary to his pension. Toland had been a lieutenant, J.G., serving aboard a destroyer based at Pearl Harbor, when he'd first noticed Martha Keegan, a junior at the University of Hawaii, majoring in psychology and minoring in surfing. They'd been happily married for 15 years now. "So," Keegan stood and lifted his rod, "how are things at the fort?" Bob Toland was a middle-level analyst at the National Security Agency. He'd left the Navy after 6 years when the adventure of uniformed service had palled. But he remained an active reservist. His work at NSA dovetailed nicely with his Naval Reserve Service. A communications expert with a degree in electronics, his current job was monitoring Soviet signals gathered by the NSA's numerous listening posts and Farret satellites. Along the way, he'd also gotten a master's in the Russian language. "Heard something real interesting last week, but I couldn't convince my boss it meant anything." "Who's your section chief?"
"Captain Albert Redman, U.S. Navy."
Toland watched a bay-built fishing boat motoring a few miles away, her captain laying out his crab pots. "He's an asshole." Keegan laughed.
"You want to be careful saying stuff like that out loud, Bob, especially seeing how you go on active duty next week. Bert worked with me, oh, must have been 15 years ago. I had to slap him down a few times. He does tend to be slightly opinionated."
"Opinionated?" Toland snorted.
"That bastard's so friggin' narrow-minded his scratch pads are only an inch wide. First there was this new arms control thing. Then I came up with something really unusual last Wednesday, and he circular-filed it. Hell, I don't know why he even bothers looking at new data. He made up his mind 5 years ago."
"I don't suppose you could tell me what it was?"
"I shouldn't." Bob wavered for a moment. Hell, if he couldn't talk with his kid's own grandfather.
"One of our ferret birds was over a Soviet military district headquarters last week and intercepted a microwaved telephone conversation. It was a report to Moscow about 4 colonels in the Carpathian military district who were being shot for gun-decking readiness reports. The story on their court-martial and execution was being set up for publication, probably in a Red Star this week." He had entirely forgotten about the oil field fire.
"Oh?"
Keegan's eyebrows went up.
"And what did Bert say?"
"He said, it's goddamned about time they cleaned their act up. And that was that."
"And what do you say?"
"Pop, I'm not in trends and intentions. Those idiot fortune tellers. But I know that even the Russians don't kill people for jollies. When Ivan kills people publicly, he does it to make a point. These were not manpower officers taking bribes to fake deferments. They weren't popped for stealing diesel fuel or building dachas with pilfered lumber. I checked our records, and it turned out we have files on 2 of them. They were both experienced line officers, both with combat experience in Afghanistan, both party members in good standing. One was a graduate of Frunze Academy, and he even had a few articles published in Military Thought, for God's sake. But all 4 were court-martialed for falsifying their regimental readiness reports, and shot 3 days later. That story will hit the streets in Krasnaya Zvezda over the next few days as a 2- or 3-part story under the Observer's byline. And that makes it a political exercise with a capital P.
The Observer was the cover name for any number of high-ranking officers who contributed to Red Star, the daily newspaper of the Soviet Armed Services. Anything on the front page and under that byline was taken quite seriously, both in the Soviet military services and by those whose job it was to watch them. Because this byline was used explicitly to make policy statements approved by both the military high command and the Politburo in Moscow. "A multi-part story?" Keegan asked. "Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about it. The repetition means they really want this lesson to sink in. Everything about this is out of pattern, Pop. Something funny is happening. They do shoot officers and EMs, but not full colonels who've written for the Journal of the General Staff, and not for faking a few lines in a readiness statement." He let out a long breath, happy to have gotten this off his chest. The workboat was proceeding south, her wake rippling out toward them in parallel lines on the mirrored surface. The image made Toland wish for his camera.
"Makes sense," Keegan mumbled.
"Huh?"
"What you just said. That does sound out of pattern."
"Yep. I stayed in late last night, running down a hunch. In the past 5 years, the Red Army has published the names of exactly 14 executed officers, none higher than a full colonel. And even then only one, a manpower officer in Soviet Georgia. The guy was taking payoffs for deferments. The others broke down into one case of spying, for us or somebody, three derelictions of duty while under the influence of alcohol, and nine conventional corruption cases, selling everything from gasoline to a whole mainframe computer in Alievo, on the left, the shadow market. Now, all of a sudden, they waste four regimental commanders, all in the same military district."
"You could take that to Redmond," Keegan suggested.
"Waste of time. Those other cases, I seem to remember the three guys who... Yeah, that was part of the temperance campaign. Too many guys turn up drunk on duty, and they pick three volunteers. Pour encourager les autres." Bob shook his head.
"Geez, Voltaire would have loved these guys."
"You talk with people who are into civilian intelligence?"
"No, my crowd is all military telecommunications."
"At lunch last Monday, I think, I was talking with a guy from Langley. Ex-army, we go way back. Anyway, he was joking that there's a new shortage over there."
"Another one?"
Bob was amused. Shortages were nothing new in Russia. 1 month, toothpaste, or toilet paper, or windshield wipers. He had heard of many such things over lunch at the NSA commissary.
"Yeah, car and truck batteries."
"Really?"
"Yeah, for the last month you can't get a battery for your car or truck over there. A lot of cars are not moving, and batteries are being stolen left and right. So people are disconnecting their batteries at night and taking them home, would you believe?"
"But Toliadishtat," Toland said, and stopped.
He referred to the massive auto factory city in European Russia, the construction of which was a hero project for which thousands of workers had been mobilized. Among the most modern auto complexes in the world, it had been built mainly with Italian technology.
"They have a hell of a battery manufacturing facility there. Hasn't blown up, has it?"
"Working three shifts. What do you think of that?"
Norfolk, Virginia. Toland examined himself in the full-sized mirror in the Norfolk BOQ complex. He'd made the drive down the evening before. The uniform still fit, he noted. Maybe a little tight at the waist, but that was nature at work, wasn't it? His salad bar of decorations was a bleak row and a half, but he had his surface warfare officer's badge, his water wings. He hadn't always been a glorified radio operator. His sleeves bore the 2½ stripes of a lieutenant commander. A final swipe of a cloth across his shoes, and he was out the door, ready on this bright Monday morning for his annual 2 weeks of duty with the fleet. 5 minutes later, he was driving down Mitcher Avenue toward headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief Atlantic Fleet, Sinclair Fleet, a flat, thoroughly undistinguished building
that had once been a hospital. An habitual early riser, Toland found the Ingersoll Street parking lot half empty. But he was still careful to take an unmarked space, lest he incur the wrath of a senior officer.
"Bob? Bob Toland!" a voice called. "Ed Morris!"
It was now Commander Edward Morris, USN, Toland noted, and a shiny gold star on his uniform jacket designated him as the commander of some ship or other. Toland saluted his friend before shaking hands.
"Still playing bridge, Bob?"
Toland, Morris, and two other officers had once established the most regular bridge foursome at the Pearl Harbor Officers Club.
"Some. Marty isn't much of a card player, but we got a bunch at work that meets once a week."
"Good as we used to be?" Morris asked, as they headed off in the same direction.
"Are you kidding? You know where I work now?"
"I heard you ended up at Fort Meade after you hung it up."
"Yeah, and there's bridge players at NSA who are wired into the damn computers. I'm talking assassins."
"So, how's the family?"
"Just great. How's yours?"
"Growing up too damn fast. Makes you feel old."
"That's the truth," Toland chuckled.
He jabbed a finger at his friend Star.
"Now you can tell me about your new kid."
"Look at my car."
Toland turned around.
Morris's Ford had a personalized license plate, FF-1094. To the uninitiated, it was an ordinary license number. But to a sailor, it advertised his command. Anti-submarine frigate number 1094, USS Farris.
"You always were nice and modest," Toland noted with a grin.
"That's all right, Ed. How long you had her?"
2 years. She's big, she's pretty, and she's mine.
You should have stayed in, Bob. The day I took command, hell, it was like the day Jimmy was born."
"I hear you.
The difference, Ed, is that I always knew you'd have your ship, and I always knew I wouldn't." In Toland's personnel jacket was a letter of admonishment for grounding a destroyer while he had the deck. It had been no more than bad luck. An ambiguity on the chart and adverse tidal conditions had caused the error, but it didn't take much to ruin a Navy career.
"So, doing your 2 weeks?"
"That's right."
"Celia is off visiting her parents, and I'm batching it. What are you doing for dinner tonight?"
"McDonald's?" Toland laughed.
"Like hell. Danny McCafferty's in town, too. He's got the Chicago tied up at Pier 22. You know, if we can scare up a fourth, maybe we can play a little bridge just like the old days."
Morris poked his friend in the chest.
"I gotta head along. Meet me in the Oak Club lobby at 17:30, Bob. Danny invited me over to his boat for dinner at 18:30, and we'll have an hour's worth of attitude adjustment before we drive over. We'll have dinner in the wardroom and a few hours of cards, just like old times."
"Aye, aye, Commander."
"Anyway, there I was on Will Rogers," McCafferty said. 50 days out on patrol, and I got the watch, right? Sonar says they have a goofy signal, bearing 052. We're at periscope depth, so I put the search scope up, train it out to 052, and sure enough, there's this Gulfstream 36 sailboat, moving along at 4 or 5 knots with the auto-steering rig set. What the hell, it's a dull day, so I flipped the scope to high power. And guess what? The captain and the mate, there's one gal who'll never drown, are on top of the deckhouse, horizontal and superimposed. The boat was maybe 1,000 yards away, just like being there. So we turn on the scope TV camera and get the tape machine running. Had to maneuver for a better view, of course. Lasted 15 minutes. The crew ran the tape for the next week. Great for morale to know just what you're fighting for."
All three officers laughed.
"Like I always told you, Bob," Morris noted, "these sub-drivers are a nasty, sneaky bunch. Not to mention perverts."
"So how long you had the Chicago, Danny?" Toland asked over his second cup of after-dinner coffee. The three had the submarine's wardroom to themselves. The only officers aboard were either standing watch or asleep.
3 busy months, not counting yard time," McCafferty said, finishing off his milk.
He was the first skipper for the new attack sub, the best of all possible worlds, a captain and a plank owner. Toland noted that Dan had not joined him and Morris for attitude adjustment at the base officers' club, during which they'd tossed down 3 stiff drinks apiece. It wasn't like the McCafferty of old. Perhaps he was unwilling to leave his sub, lest the dream of his career somehow end while he was away from her. "Can't you tell from the pale, pasty look common to cave-dwellers and submariners?" Morris joked. "Not to mention the faint glow associated with nuclear reactor types." McCafferty grinned, and they waited for their 4th to arrive. He was a junior engineer, just about to come off reactor watch. Chicago's reactor wasn't operating. She was drawing electrical power from the dock. But regulations demanded a full reactor watch, whether the tea kettle was working or not.
"I tell you guys, I was a little pale 4 weeks ago."
McCafferty turned serious, or about as serious as he ever got.
"How so?" Bob Toland asked.
"Well, you know the kind of shit we do with these boats, right?"
"If you mean inshore intelligence gathering, Dan, you ought to know that that electronic intelligence stuff you collect comes to my office. Hell, I probably know the people who originate a lot of the data requests that generate your op orders." "How's that for a revolting thought?" Bob laughed. He fought the urge to look around too obviously. He'd never been aboard a nuclear submarine before. It was cold. Nuclear subs have nuclear-powered air conditioning, and the air was heavy with the smell of machine oil. Everything he could see sparkled both from being almost new and from the fact that McCafferty had undoubtedly made sure that his crew had gotten things looking especially good for his friends. So this was the billion-dollar machine that gathered all that ELINT data.
"Yeah, well, we were up in the Barents Sea, you know, northeast of the Kola Fjord, trailing a Russian sub, an Oscar, about, 10 miles back of her. And all of a sudden we find ourselves in the middle of a friggin' live-fire exercise. Missiles were flying all over the damn place. They wasted 3 old hulks and blasted hell out of a half-dozen target barges."
"Just the Oscar?" Morris asked.
"Turned out there was a Papa and a Mike out there, too. That's one problem with us being so quiet in these babies. If they don't know we're there, we can find ourselves in the middle of some really unpleasant shit. Anyway, sonar starts screaming, 'Transients! Transients!' from all the missile tubes being flooded. No way we could be sure they weren't getting ready to put some real torpedoes in the water. But we stuck up the ESM and picked up their periscope radars. Then I saw some of the things whipping over our heads. Damn, guys, for about 3 minutes there it was just a little hairy, you know."
McCafferty shook his head.
"Anyway, 2 hours after that, all 3 boats crack on 20 knots and head back to the barn. Your basic out-and-in live fire. How's that for a lively first deployment?"
"You get the feeling that the Russians are doing anything out of the ordinary, Dan?" Toland asked, suddenly interested.
"You didn't hear?"
"Hear what?"
"They've cut back their diesel sub-patrols up north quite a bit, too. I mean, normally they're pretty hard to hear, but mostly over the past 2 months, they just ain't there. I heard one. Just one. Wasn't like that the last time I was up north. There have been some satellite photos of them, a lot of diesel boats tied up alongside for some reason or another. In fact, their patrol activity up north is down across the board, with a lot of maintenance activity going on. The current guess is that they're changing their training cycle. This isn't the usual time of year for live firing."
McCafferty laughed.
"Of course, it could be that they finally got tired of chipping and painting those old cans and decided to use them up. Best thing to do with a can anyway."
"Bubblehead," Morris snorted.
"Give me a reason you'd have a bunch of diesel boats out of service all at once," Toland said.
He was wishing that he'd passed on the 2nd and 3rd rounds during happy hour. Something important was flashing lights inside his head, and the alcohol was slowing his thinking down.
"Shit," McCafferty observed.
"There isn't any."
"So what are they doing with the diesel boats?"
I haven't seen the satellite photos, Bob, just heard about them. No special activity in the dry docks, though, so it can't be too major.
The light bulb finally went off in Tolan's head.
How hard is it to change batteries in a sub?
It's a nasty, heavy job.
I mean, you don't need special machinery or anything. We do it with Tiger teams, and it takes something like 3 or 4 weeks. Ivan subs are designed with larger battery capacities than ours, and also for easier battery replacement. They're supposed to go through their batteries faster than Western subs, and they compensate for it by making replacement easier. Hard patches on the hull, things like that. So for them, it's probably an all-hands evolution.
What exactly are you getting at, Bob?
Toland related the story about the 4 Soviet colonels who had been shot and why. Then I hear this story about how the supply of batteries in Russia has dried up. No batteries for cars or trucks. The car batteries I can understand, but the trucks? Hey, every truck in Russia is government-owned. They all have mobilization uses. Same sort of batteries, right?
Yeah, they all use lead-acid batteries. The factory burned down? Commander Morris asked.
I know Ivan likes one big factory rather than a bunch of little ones.
It's working 3 shifts.
McCafferty sat back, away from the table.
So, what uses batteries? Morris asked rhetorically.
Submarines, McCafferty pronounced. Tanks, armored vehicles, command cars, starter carts for planes. Lots of stuff painted green, you know.
Bob, what you're saying... Shit, what you're saying is that all of a sudden, Ivan has decided to increase his readiness across the board.
Question. Do you know what the hell you're talking about?
You can bet your ass on it, Danny.
The bit on the 4 colonels crossed my desk. I eyeballed that report myself. It was received on one of our ferret satellites. Ivan doesn't know how sensitive those hitchhiker birds are, and he still sends a lot of stuff in the clear on surface microwave nets. We listen in to voice and telex transmissions all the time.
You guys can forget you heard that, okay?
Toland got nods from the others.
The thing about the batteries I picked up by accident, but I confirmed it with a guy I know in the Pentagon.
Now we have your story about increased live fire exercises, Dan.
You just filled in a blank space.
Now, if we can confirm that those diesel boats really are down for battery replacement, we have the beginnings of a picture.
Just how important are new batteries for a diesel boat?
Very important, the sub-skipper said. Depends a lot on quality control and maintenance, but new ones can give you up to double the range and power of old ones. And that's obviously an important tactical factor.
Jesus, you know what this sounds like? Ivan's always ready to go to sea, and now it looks like he wants to be real ready, Morris observed.
But the papers all say that they're acting like born-again angels with this arms control stuff.
Something does not compute, gentlemen.
I have to get this to someone in the chain of command. I could drop this on a desk at Fort Meade, and it might never get anywhere, Tolan said, remembering his section chief.
You will, McCafferty said after a moment's pause. I have an appointment tomorrow morning with Comm Sublant. I think you're coming with me, Bob.
The last member of the foursome arrived 10 minutes later. He was disappointed with the quality of the game. He'd thought his skipper was better than this.
Toland spent 20 minutes reviewing his data in front of Vice Admiral Richard Pipes, Commander, Submarine Force, U.S. Atlantic Fleet. Pipes was the first black submariner to make 3-star rank, a man who had paid his dues with performance as he'd climbed up the ladder in what had traditionally been a whites-only profession, and he had the reputation of a tough, demanding boss. The Admiral listened without a word as he sipped coffee from a 3-starred mug. He'd been annoyed to have McCafferty's patrol report supplanted by a speech from a reservist, but that attitude had lasted only 3 minutes. Now the lines around his mouth deepened.
"Son, you violated a few security restrictions to give me some of that."
"I know that, sir," Toland said.
Took balls to do that. And it's nice to see in a young officer, what with all the ones who just want to cover their ass.
Pipes rose.
I don't like what you just told me, son, not one little bit. We got Ivan playing Santa Claus with all this diplomatic horseshit, and at the same time he's dialing his submarine force in. Could be a coincidence. Then again, it might not be. How about you and me go over to talk with Sinclair and his intelligence chief?
Toland winced. What have I got myself into?
Sir, I'm down here for a training rotation, not to... Looks to me like you got this intelligence crap down pretty pat, Commander. You believe what you just told me is true?
Toland stiffened.
Yes, sir. Then I'm giving you a chance to prove it. You afraid to stick your neck out? Or do you just offer opinions to relatives and friends?
The Admiral asked harshly.
Toland had heard that Pipes was a real hard case. The reservist rose to his feet.
Let's do it, Admiral.
Pipes picked up his phone and dialed in a 3-digit number, his direct line to Sinclair.
Bill?
Dick.
I got a boy in my office I think you ought to talk to. Remember what we discussed last Thursday? We may have confirmation.
A brief pause.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Aye, aye, sir. On the way.
Pipes set the phone down.
McCafferty, thank you for bringing this man in with you. We'll go over your patrol report this afternoon. Be here at 15:30. Toland, you come along with me.
An hour later, Lieutenant Commander Robert M. Toland, USNRR, was informed that he had been placed on extended active duty by order of the Secretary of Defense. In fact, it was by order of Sinclair, but the forms would be correctly filled out in a week or so. At lunch that day in flag country of Building 1 of the complex, Sinclair called in all his type commanders. The 3-star admirals who controlled the aircraft, surface ships, submarines, and replenishment ships. The conversation was subdued and ceased entirely when the stewards came in to change the courses. They were all in their 50s, experienced, serious men, who both made and implemented policy, preparing for something they hoped would never come. This hope continued, but by the time each had finished his second cup of coffee, it was decided that fleet training cycles would be increased, and a few surprise inspections would be made. Sinclair made an appointment with the Chief of Naval Operations for the following morning, and his Deputy Intelligence Chief boarded a commercial airliner for a quick trip to Pearl Harbor, to meet with his opposite number in the Pacific. Toland was relieved of his post and transferred to Intentions, part of Sinclair's Personal Intelligence Advisory Staff.
Chapter 6. The Watchers. Norfolk, Virginia. Intentions was a small second-floor office normally occupied by 4 officers. Shoehorning Toland in there was difficult, mainly because all the classified material had to be covered up while the civilian movers got the desk in place. When they finally left, Bob found he had just about enough space to get into and out of his swivel chair. The office door had a cipher lock with 5 rocker switches concealed in a steel container. Located in the northwest corner of Sinclair headquarters, the office's barred windows overlooked a highway and little else. The drab curtains were closed anyway. Inside, the walls might have been painted beige once, but the plaster had whitened from underneath to give the office the sort of pallor expected in a yellow fever ward. The senior officer was a Marine colonel named Chuck Lowe, who had watched the moving-in process with a silent resentment that Bob only understood when the man got to his feet.
"I may never make it to the head now," Lowe grumped, sticking his cast around the corner of his desk. They shook hands.
"What happened to the leg, Colonel?"
"Mountain warfare school out in California, day after Christmas. Skiing on my own goddamn time. The docs say you should never break the tibia close to the bottom," Lowe explained with an ironic smile.
"And you never get used to the itching. Should have this thing off in another 3 or 4 weeks.
Then I have to get used to running again. You know, I spent 3 years trying to break my ass out of Intel, then I finally get my goddamned regiment, and this happens. Welcome aboard, Toland. Why don't you grab us both a cup of coffee?
There was a pot atop the farthest filing cabinet. The other three officers, Lo explained, were giving a briefing.
I saw the write-up you gave Sinklant. Interesting stuff. What do you think Ivan's up to?
It looks like he's increasing readiness across the board, Colonel.
In here you can call me Chuck.
Fine. I'm Bob.
You do signal intelligence at NSA, right?
You're one of the satellite specialists, I heard.
Toland nodded.
Ours and theirs, mostly ours. I see photos from time to time, but mostly I do signals work. That's how we twigged to the report on the four colonels. There has also been a fair amount of operational maneuvering done, more than usual for this time of year. Ivan's been a little freer with how his tankers drive around, too, less concerned about running a battalion across a plowed field, for example.
And you're supposed to have a look at anything that's unusual, no matter how dumb it seems, right? That gives you a pretty wide brief, doesn't it? We got something interesting along those lines from DIA. Have a look at these.
Lo pulled a pair of 8x10 photographs from a manila envelope and handed them to Toland. They seemed to show the same parcel of land, but from slightly different angles and different times of year. In the upper left corner was a pair of isbas, the crude huts of Russian peasant life. Toland looked up.
Collective farm?
Yeah. Number 1196. A little one about 200 clicks northwest of Moscow. Tell me what's different between the two.
Toland looked back at the photos.
In one was a straight line of fenced gardens, perhaps an acre each. In the other, he could see a new fence for four of the patches, and one patch whose fenced area had been roughly doubled.
A colonel, army type, I used to work with sent me these. Thought I'd find it amusing. I grew up on a corn farm in Iowa, you see.
So Ivan's increasing the private patches for the farmers to work on their own, eh?
Looks that way.
Hasn't been announced, has it?
I haven't read anything about it.
Toland didn't read the government's secret in-house publication, National Intelligence Digest, but the NSA cafeteria gossip usually covered harmless stuff like this. Intelligence types talked shop as much as any others.
Lo shook his head slightly.
Nope, and that's a little odd. It's something they should announce. The papers would call that another sure sign of the liberalization trend we've been seeing.
Just this one farm, maybe?
As a matter of fact, they've seen the same thing at five other places. But we don't generally use our recon sats for this sort of thing. They got this on a slow news day, I suppose. The important stuff must have been covered by clouds.
Toland nodded agreement. The reconnaissance satellites were used to evaluate Soviet grain crops, but that happened later in the year. The Russians knew it also, since it had been in the open press for over a decade, explaining why there was a team of agronomists in the U.S. Department of Agriculture with special intelligence compartmented security clearance.
Kind of late in the season to do that, isn't it? I mean, will it do any good to give them this land this time of year?
I got these a week ago. I think they're a little older than that. This is about the time most of their farms start planting. It stays cold there quite a long time, remember? But the high latitudes make up for it with longer summer days. Assume that this is a nationwide move on their part. Evaluate that for me, Bob.
The colonel's eyes narrowed briefly.
Smart move on their part, obviously. It could solve a lot of their food supply problems, particularly for truck farm stuff, I guess. Tomatoes, onions, that sort of thing.
Maybe. You might also note that this sort of farming is manpower-intensive, but not machinery-intensive.
What about the demographic aspect of the move?
Toland blinked.
There was a tendency in the U.S. Navy to assume that since they made their living by charging into machine gun fire, Marines were dumb.
Most of the Kokolsniki are relatively old folks. The median age is in the late 40s, early 50s. So most of the private plots are managed by the older people, while the mechanized work, like driving the combines and trucks,
which pays a hell of a lot better,
is done by the younger workers.
You're telling me that this way they can increase some food production without the younger men
of military service age.
One way to look at it, Lowe said. Politically, it's dynamite. You can't take away things people already have. Back in the early 60s, a rumor, wasn't even true, got started to the effect that Khrushchev was going to reduce or eliminate the private plots those poor bastards get. There was hell to pay. I was in the language school at Monterey then, and I remember the Russian papers that came through the language school. They spent weeks denying the story. Those private plots are the most productive sector of their agricultural system. Less than 2% of their arable land, it produces about half of their fruit and potatoes, more than a third of their eggs, vegetables, and meat. Hell, it's the only part of the damned agricultural system that works. The big shots over there have known for years that by doing this, they could solve their food shortage problems, and still they haven't done it for political reasons. They couldn't run the risk of state sponsorship for a whole new generation of kulaks. Until now. But it appears they've done it without making a formal announcement. And it just so happens that they are increasing their military readiness at the same time. I never believe in coincidences, even when I'm a dumb line officer running across a beach.
Lowe's uniform blouse hung in the corner. Toland sipped at his coffee and surveyed its four rows of decorations. There were three repeat pips on his Vietnam service ribbon and a Navy cross. Dressed in the olive-green sweater affected by Marine officers, Lowe was not a big man, and his Midwest accent gave evidence of a relaxed, almost bored outlook on life. But his brown eyes said something else entirely. Colonel Lowe was thinking along Toland's lines already, and he was not the least happy about it.
Chuck, if they are really preparing for some action, action on a large scale, they just can't mess with a few colonels. Something else will start showing up. They'll have to do some work at the bottom, too.
Yeah, that's the next thing we have to look for. I sent a request into DIA yesterday. From now on, when Red Star comes out, the attaché in Moscow will send a photo facsimile to us via satellite. If they start doing that, it'll sure as hell turn up in Krasnaya Zvezda. Bob, I think you've opened a very interesting can of worms, and you're not going to be alone examining it.
Toland finished his coffee. The Soviets had taken an entire class of fleet ballistic missile submarines out of service. They were conducting arms talks in Vienna. They were buying grain from America and Canada under surprisingly favorable terms, even allowing American hulls to handle 20% of the cargo. How did this jibe with the signs he had seen? Logically, it didn't, except in one specific case. And that wasn't possible. Was it?
Shpola, the Ukraine. The crashing sound of the 125mm tank gun was enough to strip the hair off your head, Alexeyev thought. But after 5 hours of running this exercise, it came through his ear protectors as a dull ringing sound. This morning the ground had been covered with grass and dotted with new saplings. But now it was a uniform wasteland of mud, marked only with the tread marks of T-80 main battle tanks and BMP-armored infantry fighting vehicles. 3 times the regiment had run this exercise, simulating a frontal assault of tanks and mounted infantry against an enemy of equal strength. 90 mobile guns had supplied fire support, along with a battery of rocket launchers. 3 times.
Alexeyev turned, removing his helmet and earmuffs, to look at the regimental commander.
A guards regiment, eh, comrade colonel? Elite soldiers of the Red Army? These tit-sucking children couldn't guard a Turkish whorehouse, much less do anything worthwhile inside of it. And what have you been doing for the past 4 years commanding this rolling circus, comrade colonel? You have learned to kill your whole command 3 times. Your artillery observers are not located properly. Your tanks and infantry carriers still can't coordinate their movements, and your tank gunners can't find targets 3 meters high. If that had been a NATO force holding that ridge, you and your command would be dead!
Alexeyev examined the colonel's face. His demeanor was changing from red fear to white anger. Good.
The loss of these people is no great penalty for the state, but that is valuable equipment. Burning valuable fuel, shooting valuable ordnance, and taking up my valuable time. Comrade Colonel, I must leave you now. First I will throw up. Then I will fly to my command post. I will be back. When I come back, we will run this exercise again. Your men will perform properly, Comrade Colonel, or you will spend the rest of your miserable life counting trees.
Alexeyev stomped off, not even acknowledging the colonel's salute. His adjutant, a full colonel of tank troops, held open the door and got in behind his boss.
"Shaping up rather well, eh?" Alexeyev asked.
"Not well enough, but there has been progress," the colonel allowed. "They have only another 6 weeks before they have to start moving west." It was the wrong thing to say. Alexeyev had spent 2 weeks chivying this division toward combat readiness, only to learn the day before that it had been allocated to Germany instead of toward his own as yet incomplete plan to descend into Iraq and Iran. Already 4 divisions, all of his elite guards tank units, had been taken away, and each change in Sink Southwest's order of battle forced him to restructure his own plan for the Gulf. An endless circle. He was being forced to select less ready units, forcing Alexeyev to devote more time to unit training and less time to the plan that had to be completed in another 2 weeks.
"Those men are going to have a very busy 6 weeks. What about the commander?" the colonel asked.
Alexeyev shrugged.
"He's been in this job too long. 45 is too old for this kind of command. And he reads his fucking parade manuals too much instead of going out in the field. But a good man. Too good to be sent counting trees."
Alexeyev chuckled heavily. It was a Russian saying that dated back to the Tsars. People exiled to Siberia were said to have nothing to do but count trees. Another of the things Lenin had changed. Now people in the Gulag had plenty to do. "The last 2 times they did well enough to succeed, I think. This regiment will be ready, along with the whole division."
USS Farris. "Bridge, sonar. We have a contact bearing 094, announced a voice on the bulkhead-mounted speaker. Commander Morris turned in his elevated swivel chair to watch his officer of the deck respond. The OOD trained his binoculars to the direction of the contact. There was nothing there. "Bearing is clear." Morris got up from his chair.
"Set condition 1AS.
"Aye, aye, battle stations," the OOD acknowledged the order. The bosun's mate of the watch walked to the announcing system and blew a 3-note whistle on his bosun's pipe into the speaker.
"General quarters, general quarters. All hands man your battle stations for anti-submarine warfare."
The alarm gong came next, and a quiet forenoon watch ended. Morris went aft, down the ladder to the Combat Information Center, or CIC. His executive officer would take the con at the bridge, allowing the captain to control the ship's weapons and sensors from her tactical nerve center. All over the ship, men were running to stations. Watertight doors and hatches were dropped into place,
and dogged down to give the ship full watertight integrity. Damage control parties donned emergency